What begins as the private musings of a typical 15-year-old girl transforms into one of literature's most harrowing descents into addiction. Before the first pill, before the first needle, there was just a teenager with ordinary problems, feeling overweight, worrying about boys, fighting with parents over messy rooms. She's bright, introspective, and painfully insecure. "I sometimes wonder which parts of myself are real and which come from books," she confesses, revealing a malleable identity that makes her particularly vulnerable. When her family moves to a new town, her social isolation becomes unbearable. While her siblings easily make friends, she spends lunch periods hiding in bathroom stalls, wondering what fundamental flaw makes her so unlovable. This crushing loneliness creates the perfect void for drugs to fill, a void many teenagers still recognize today. Her ordinary struggles make what follows all the more terrifying because they remind us how thin the line can be between typical adolescent pain and life-altering addiction. The journey into addiction begins with betrayal. Someone slips LSD into her drink at a party. The experience is both terrifying and transcendent. "I could smell and touch each note of music." Rationalization follows swiftly. "All the warnings about LSD must have been written by uninformed people like my parents." Within days, she's seeking marijuana, comparing herself to Alice in Wonderland, exploring a completely new world. The progression accelerates alarmingly, from acid to torpedoes to injected speed, each crossing boundaries that seemed unthinkable before. Drugs offer not just escape, but transformation. "I danced like never before, free, abandoned, a perfected specimen of a perfected species." For someone who has felt fundamentally flawed her entire life, this sense of perfection is irresistible. Recreational experimentation quickly becomes her existence's organizing principle. Daily life revolves entirely around drugs, with everything else, school, family, former interests, falling away. Ethical boundaries dissolve one by one. When she provides drugs to younger children, even her altered conscience recognizes a line crossed. Her relationship with Richie reveals compromised judgment, believing herself in love while being manipulated. Most disturbing is how substances rob her of autonomy. Her first sexual experience occurs while intoxicated, leaving immediate regret. "I'm sorry because I had different hopes for this significant life event." Her physical deterioration becomes undeniable, needing stimulants to function and sedatives to sleep. Fleeing to San Francisco with her friend Chris represents both desperation and hope, a chance to start fresh where no one knows their history. Chris and I have decided to leave for San Francisco, where we won't know any users and can stay clean, she writes with genuine determination. But geographical escape proves insufficient to address addiction's root causes. The harsh realities of independence quickly overwhelm them as they struggle to find work without experience or references, ending up in a dirty, stifling one-room apartment far from the bohemian paradise they imagined. The monotony of poverty, get up, eat, work, eat, fall into bed exhausted, makes the escape offered by drugs increasingly tempting. When temptation finally appears at Sheila's sophisticated party, their resolve crumbles instantly. What follows reveals the predatory underbelly of drug culture. After introducing the girls to heroin, Sheila and her boyfriend Rod sexually assault them while they're unconscious. This horrific exploitation demonstrates how addiction renders young people, especially young women, profoundly vulnerable. Their brief success opening a boutique near Berkeley offers a heartbreaking glimpse of what might have been possible. Their creativity, entrepreneurship, and connection with customers suggesting alternate paths tragically foreclosed by addiction. Coming home initially feels like salvation, like the prodigal son welcomed home. The warmth of family creates a security she desperately needs. But recovery proves more complex than changing location. The psychological damage persists, and she struggles with profound shame. "I wish I could tear out the last 6 months of my life like calendar pages." Her former drug connections view her attempt to get clean as betrayal, escalating from verbal intimidation to physical assault. She needs protection, but fears burdening her parents with the truth. This pressure eventually triggers relapse. Anyone who says pot and acid aren't addictive is an idiot. Life without drugs is colorless and bare, capturing how substances become entwined with one's sense of meaning. After another period of homelessness, she's committed to a state mental hospital. Her description is chilling: a smelly, dingy hallway through locked doors, where patients are locked back in our wards like zoo animals at 4:30 p.m. Dr. Miller insists she must admit I have a problem before they can help, failing to recognize her situation's complexity. Group therapy provides one positive experience, with President Carter encouraging her to express your fears openly. Upon release, she expresses gratitude for my own room with my own curtains, highlighting how institutionalization strips away basic dignities. Following her release, a period of genuine hope emerges. A family trip east provides distance from her hometown's drug scene. She meets Joel, a hard-working university freshman offering stability and affection. Her musical talents surface when invited to be the soloist at her outstanding student recital. These developments hinted a life beyond addiction, built on authentic connection, creative expression, and renewed purpose. The deception cycle had already resumed as she began lying to her parents while reconnecting with drug-using peers. Caught during a police raid, she and Chris convinced our parents it was our first time and nothing had happened, demonstrating how easily manipulation returns. Her parents' increased surveillance only pushed her away further. Yet her final entries expressed genuine hope about returning to school and newfound appreciation for communication. She had even articulated a philosophy about moving beyond diaries. "Diaries are great when you're young. You save my sanity a million times, but I think older people should discuss their problems with others instead of just with themselves." The epilogue delivers the book's devastating final blow. The subject of this book died 3 weeks after deciding not to keep another diary. This abrupt conclusion casts her hard-won progress in the shadow of ultimate defeat. The ambiguity about whether her death was an accidental or premeditated overdose leaves us with unanswerable questions. What makes this ending particularly haunting is how it follows apparent recovery, reconnection with family, love with Joel, discovering her piano talent, and new friendships. The epilogue statement that she died, one of thousands of drug deaths that year, places her individual tragedy within a broader social context, transforming her diary from personal narrative into universal warning. Go Ask Alice endures because it captures the universal adolescent struggle to form identity. The narrator tries on different selves: good daughter, rebellious teen, sophisticated drug user, repentant returnee, without fully inhabiting any. The generation gap features prominently, yet she also questions her peers' revolutionary rhetoric. This ambivalence reflects her position between worlds. The tragedy lies not just in her death, but in the emerging maturity cut short. Addiction's theft not only of life, but of potential. All the selves she might have become if given the chance to grow.